This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey everyone, thanks so much for joining me. So, we made it through the Night Country, and everyone is talking about that finale. That's showrunner Issa Lopez's True Detective Night Country, starring Jodie Foster and Kaylee Reese, playing two detectives investigating the disappearance of eight men who operate the Salal Arctic Research Station in Ennis, Alaska. And it's been a success. HBO said recently that it's the most watched season of the entire True Detective anthology series. I got to jump on a Zoom call with breakout star Finn Bennett, who plays Peter Pryor, the young cop whose arc takes an almost biblical turn. If you've not caught up with the finale, you might want to do so before listening to our conversation. We talk about his character Peter's trajectory to Dirty Cop, about working with Jodie Foster and the parallels to Clarice Starling, his thoughts on True Detective creator Nick Pizzolatto's comments, and the most interesting and crazy fan theories.
You got six dead bodies in the local ice rink. You have protests around the mine. You need to get the shit under control.
That video. There aren't any ice caves near where her body was found.
Death trap. There were a bunch of accidents up there years ago. The men are out there looking for Clark.
Where is he hiding?
It takes us one by one.
There's nothing except us.
We're all in the Night Country now.
Finn, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Congratulations on this incredible show. I've been on the edge of my seat every episode, and as one says, you really stuck the landing. Such a success. Have you been able to enjoy the ride?
I'm loving it. I'm so proud of the series. And thank you so much for, you know, kind of being on the edge of your seat. I'm really like happy we get to show it to the world. Enjoying the ride is a difficult one because you're like on the edge of your seat, hoping that people will love it. And so far, people have been loving it. So I'm really happy. I don't want to like enjoy myself too much. I'm quite like keen to get like stuck into work again and so on. But I wake up in the morning and like somebody might have left me like a nice message or say on Instagram or something. And that's really lovely. Like that's, you know, it's a very warm feeling.
But I have to say, I have been worried about Peter, almost giving me a heart attack a few times. And the reason for this is because he seems particularly pure in his good intentions as a police officer, as a husband, as a son. But as a seasoned TV film watcher, that type of character, tick, tick, tick.
Yeah.
Did you play it that way?
I think I try to ignore what a traditional TV arc would look like, even though like I love watching TV, and you know like when I read episode one, I was like, oh yeah, he's doomed. But no, obviously he comes out the other end. I think I really like that about Issa's writing. Issa comes from horror, and for her, I remember we would have kind of chats about like what happens to the character after. And obviously, because I'm an actor and I love to make it all about myself, I would be like, you know, I think he's depressed. I think he drinks. I think he becomes more like his father. He might become a crooked cop. And she was like, no, you're being melodramatic. He's okay. He's like scarred. And he finally has some kind of emotional baggage. I think Pete comes into the series. All of the characters have real emotional baggage. And he's kind of like this Labrador who just kind of is like, I'm on the case. I love that.
In terms of Danvers, the Jodie Foster character, I mean, she pulls him away from his wife, Kayla. She's quite tough on him, but it still feels like she's a maternal figure for him. Why did you figure that?
There's obviously the absence of a mother in Pete's life. We discussed that Pete's mother had probably left the family when Pete was young. I lost my mother when I was 14. She didn't leave my family, but she passed. And I think, sorry. Oh, no, that's all right. But one always looks to a woman to fill that role. I'm really lucky, and I've had many like fantastic older women to kind of fill that role for me. And, you know, going into True Detective, I just got a bunch more, you know, all these amazing women. Who I really look up to. I mean, it's just like incredible seeing all of them depressed and just being like, wow, I know those people. I think Pete looks for that because he doesn't have that. Unfortunately, kind of no matter how mean she is, it's also slim pickings in NS Alaska. And he forms this bond with Danvers, and he'll do anything for her, you know, like you do to impress your parents. You'll do anything for them. I think that kind of informs the choice.
So Liz Danvers has discovered that Peter's father, Hank, is interfering with the investigation, so to speak. And it ends off in this horrific biblical standoff with Peter, his dad, and this maternal figure. What did you make of Peter's decision-making here?
I tried not to kind of make it into too much of a decision. I think I tried to make it more into like a reflex in a way. He's not killing his father so much as saving Danvers. It's not something that he'll be like, yeah, I made the right choice, even though, you know, I think he made the right choice. But I don't think there'll ever be a day for the rest of his life where he doesn't think about it and what happened in that moment. We rehearsed that scene. And it changed a lot kind of with drafts of the script coming out. But the big rehearsal that basically locked everything in place was this one Sunday or Saturday at Issa's apartment in Reykjavik. And we all went around, John, Jody, Kaylee and I, and we would work through the scripts and different scenes and stuff. But this one was like a big one where we didn't quite have it locked in. We just went through what the two of them, John and Jody, are appealing to Pete about. And Danvers is appealing to something much a very rational, kind of like a moral compass that Pete, we know that Pete has. Whereas John is appealing to, sorry, Hank, I should say, is appealing to something much more emotional and sentimental. And that's really all the scene is about, is who wins in that kind of tug of war. And obviously Danvers kind of wins, but it's just a split decision. It's a split second decision. That's kind of what I make of it.
When I said I was sort of worried about Peter during the show, this ended not as I could have imagined, which is the power of Issa's writing and your work, because I didn't see it coming. But what happens to Peter is that he essentially becomes a dirty cop.
That's exactly it. Yeah. And that's kind of what makes, like, I think what makes his arc so sad and disappointing, because through this whole case, he's so like bright and earnest. And when he kind of interrogates Danvers in that scene in episode 5 and finds out that his hero is a dirty cop, it's heartbreaking for him. And then kind of a couple of scenes later, he himself becomes a dirty cop and he's now got to cover up these murders.
And that cleaning scene in the last one. Oh, that's hard.
That's the really sad thing about his arc, right? Is that he becomes everything he tried not to be.
Fine. You want to do it differently? You make up the questions. You just had to know. I had to keep digging. That's what Hank found in there. I bet he was asking you. What do they know about the mine? And bingo, his kid gives him a little present.
I wasn't digging for
anything. Yeah, go. Ask me questions. Question me.
I don't want to do that.
Ask me questions.
No, I don't want
to. You wanted to know. Ask me the fucking questions. Ask the questions, Pryor.
when I was studying film, my thesis was on The Silence of the Lambs. And it's,
oh, really?
It's
cool.
Been amazing to watch this series because I've been thinking of it sort of as a, what should I say, a circle or a companion piece. You know, Clarice Starling, you guys are both playing these really driven, the young cop, in her case, the FBI agent, really trying to prove yourselves. She's sort of coached by Hannibal Lecter with these asking the right questions, but there it is really interesting that you have to go into that dark side when you're trying to prove yourself. What was your cinematic relationship to Jodi? That was a long story to get to that.
No. I love that film so much. I rewatched it again like really recently, and I love the scenes between them. I love the scenes between, you know, with the glass, and he creeps out of the shadow. It's so brilliant. I think cinematic relationship to Jodi. I think just like in terms of my relationship to Jodi in the first place, you know, I was very, very much aware that this was Jodie Foster who I was going to work with, and that Jodie Foster had done, among Silence of the Lambs, some really brilliant work, and that's quite intimidating, and it's hard not to feel intimidated when you first meet her, and that all falls away so quickly because she's so warm and patient and kind. I saw like an interview with her recently where she was like, I just wanted to support everybody else's stories in this, and that isn't that just like such a wonderful thing for like a lead actor to say.
What did you observe of how she works on set, just looking at her?
I think she just really feels things very, very like deeply and lets them like land and stuff. I don't know if I had the answer, then I would be a twice Academy Award winner. But
young yet.
Yeah. But didn't she win one when she was like 13 or something?
Well, I mean, she was in Taxi Driver.
Anyway, but I think just observing her, you see that she takes the work seriously, and she also like gives herself space to get into the character. I think everybody's got like a very different process, and people like some actors I've met have to like take themselves off and kind of meditate, and then they can walk into a scene and do it. I think some, particularly a lot of British actors I've met, they kind of like chit chat with you right up until the last second where somebody calls action. Jodie's, I think, is maybe my favorite one, where she kind of like takes a beat before you dive into the scene, just to kind of root yourself and ground yourself, and then we dive into it. She has this like incredible dial where she'll never do the same thing twice, and I think that's like such a good thing to learn. There's no real merit, unless the director wants it, in doing the same thing twice. Mm-hmm. You know, it's give them like things to play with. So I hope I can kind of, I think it takes like a lot of confidence to be like, I'm going to do something completely different now. But I think that's one of the big things I learned from her.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You were mentioning it before, but of course with Issa, she's the first woman to helm the True Detective anthology. It's a very female-centric production on set, in the narrative. Did you feel that in any way as an actor?
Absolutely. I loved it. There's no a difference, I think. There's no egos on, there were no egos on that set. Everybody was there to like make the work and make it fun. It's respectful, and I just adored it. I would do it again in a heartbeat. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think that's the thing about watching what you filmed, is that you see it and you're like, I could do that better for you, Issa. I could do that better for you. And it was such like a supporting network.
Inevitably, there's the internet discussion from mostly men of complaints about female-centric scenes. Did you guys discuss this when it started coming up?
You mean like discussed it post the thing coming up?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't think it's really worth discussing, to be honest. I think it speaks volumes that like the bulk of bad criticism. I think people, I want to make sure that I say that people are entitled to their opinions, but I think a lot of the bad criticism is coming from complaints that there are too many women in it. And that is such a kind of, that's such like a baseless comment, you know, like that's not a criticism. Yeah. That's like, you know, that's not a critique. So I think, I don't know, we don't really talk about it that much. I think the series speaks for itself. I think obviously like you look for, despite however many good reviews you get, you still look for the bad ones, and the bad ones still hurt you. You know, when people say kind of like mean things about you on the internet, you take that to heart. But we made a TV series and a lot of people really love it. So no, I don't think we'll be proud of that.
And Issa answered beautifully to, for example, Nick Pizzolatto's. Were you disappointed with his comments?
Again, no. He made a wonderful TV series, and he obviously, I know he's kind of been liking things and stuff, and that's kind of the internet discourse on this subject. He hasn't necessarily said how he feels about Night Country. I stand behind my director in this. I think Issa handled that very eloquently, and that's what did she say? That's his prerogative. I agree with that. He is entitled to his opinions. He made a wonderful TV series, and a lot of people on the internet who are giving us bad reviews, they haven't made wonderful TV series. So you know, yeah. But I stand behind my director in that.
As you should.
Yes. Yeah.
This incredible season has ended. As I started saying, you really stuck the landing. So I thought you would join me as a viewer. There's so many theories that have circled around this show. I mean, we have that.
This is my favorite part of discourse is to see people making like theories about your show. Because some of them are so wild.
The supernatural, that the Salal guys are opening a portal to hell, that Navarro did it, that a polar bear did it. What is the funnest, weirdest theory you heard?
One of the ones that I'm not sure about, like, funnest in terms of, like, you know, like, craziest theory I heard. But I thought a really insightful one that I saw a lot of people posting was about Peter having a relationship with Annie Kay and him. Sorry, this sounds like so self-involved. I'm looking for, as soon as I see my name, I'm like, yes, of course, I'm dialed in. But no, I thought that one was fun. And the kind of Kayla's reasoning for not wanting him on the case is that she was involved or something. And I like those ones. I like those ones that are like, you know, like obviously F6 has come out now, so we can like talk about what happens. But I do like seeing those ones. And thank you to like all those people for like posting those. They're really fun. It is like, I think that's my favorite thing when people don't like critique or bash your show or even compliment it. It's my favorite thing, seeing like it's connected with people enough to like, you know, I've seen some like insane threads about like fan theories and stuff, which I really
like. What about the one that Rose isn't real?
I haven't seen that one, but that's great.
Oh no, it's a good one.
that's really great. Yeah, they have all
these things like that she actually isn't talking to anyone when you're all in the same scene, and that everyone goes to her with the bodies.
Yeah, that's such a good one. I love that one. Did you see All of Us Strangers?
Yes.
Oh, you know, and Paul Mescal isn't real. Yes. Well, you know, sorry, he is real, but like they're ghosts. I love
and
that.
Potentially also Andrew Scott is not alive when this is happening.
Wait,
that's
really?
Another theory.
Is that another theory?
Yeah, that he's in purgatory.
Oh, dude,
that's the building is empty.
Oh, really? Yeah, that. I buy it. Anyway,
but we're not talking about that. We're talking about your show. Yeah.
But yeah, in a similar sense, like it's quite like it is a supernatural show. I really like how brave Issa has been with like leaning into that.
I love that too. What about the polar bear, though? What's your theory on the polar bear
I think that,
and her son?
That polar bear, I think, is more of a nice spirit. I don't think that polar bear is a bad spirit. I don't think that polar bear was killing out here to kill. Although, you know, the Salam men kind of deserved it. But sorry, I shouldn't say that. That's an awful thing to say. Yeah, the polar bear theory, I'm less keen on. Because I like it to be somebody. I like it to be somebody. But yeah, congratulations to whoever came up with the polar bear theory. It's fun, but not quite my temper. Obviously, kind of the more spiritual side of things happens to Navarro's character. And the orange peel and the kind of the chain with the cross on it, that's like all stuff that's related to her. I like how it creeps into her childhood. But then also the thing with the polar bear and that connecting to like Jodie's kid, Danvers's kid, and how Danvers's kid kind of comes to Navarro as well. I think it creates this real like unsettling fusing of the two detectives, the two lead characters. I love, like, I think that's the essential thing about True Detective is, one, it's the place it's set in, and two, it's the chemistry between your two lead detectives. Mm-hmm. That like fusing between the two of them, because of this case and because of Annie Kay's case, they become kind of one in like the physical and the spiritual kind of side of it, the spiritual world. I think that's really exciting.
What's so incredible and satisfying about it is it combines everything. It's the sort of the political aspects, incredible injustice done to the indigenous people. You have the supernatural elements, as well as particularly the women. Tell me a little bit more about your reactions to how this ended.
So I watched it for the first time. I watched episode 6 in the editing suite. Issa and post-production, Issa did post-production in London, and she's like one of those people you just want to hang out with all the time. So I would kind of like, she was like, oh,
you
come.
Just stayed there.
Yeah. I stayed in the editing suite, but she was like, come watch the episodes. And then we watched episode 6, and it was a Thursday and it was kind of raining outside. And I remember there's that scene between the two detectives when they've got the fire on and the kind of music swells, and they have that moment where they really bond and they really fall into each other's arms. And I love that. And then kind of how it's a weird one, isn't it? You don't want to like cheer on murder. You're cheering we kind of knew them as like the justice ladies, the group of women that marched into Salal. We knew them as the justice ladies, but how much you're cheering for them is weird, right? And how like proud you are of like them avenging their friend. And I think it ties it up politically beautifully. I don't want to speak too much about that because I don't think I'm the best person to kind of talk about these issues. But I just kind of started crying and I couldn't stop. And then they all had to go, you know, all the post team had to go and they had to do some ADR or something in a different studio. And I took myself into a pub across the road and I got myself a pint. And I just kind of sat in front of it, staring out the window, just feeling kind of so drained. You know, like it's such like a kind of emotional buildup, and it's so cathartic. And I wasn't crying just because I was like so proud of what we had achieved. I think I was just so like happy for the story and happy for the characters that they ended up where they needed to be.
Feels like a cathartic, sad ending, but that had to be sort of that.
It's like a weird necessary evil, isn't it? Yeah, it's interesting.
What do you make of Navarro, that absolute last scene
when she's kind of,
and she's in the balcony, she sort of comes out to the
lovely.
What do you make? I mean, is she hiding out or is she?
Do you think she's might be alive, maybe a little spirit or something?
I don't know. I don't know.
I hope she's there. Because I like have this kind of like,
is it fan an All fiction. Of a Strangers ending? Is
I have like this fan fiction kind of like ending where the two of them like go out there and they like chill on the porch and have beers and stuff. But I hope she's there. She might be a ghost. If she is a ghost, then she's a ghost at rest, I think, and that's important. I think that thing with like Peter is that he's like, or something like horrible has happened, but everything's been, he's come over the hill. And I think that's a beautiful way to end it.
I wanted to ask you about, I'm not sure since they're in Alaska, but I know that the production worked closely with an Indigenous advisory board, tell me if I'm wrong, Inupiaq?
Inupiaq.
Inupiaq Advisory Council. What did they contribute, and most notably, what did you sort of learn about the culture?
I think that there has to be kind of like you have to kind of retrain yourself to think more sensitively about these issues. I know there were kind of like story changes, how to like handle things more sensitively. I think particularly with like Annie K's murder, it's not shot in a way that you see like acts of violence inflicted on Annie. It's on the killers the whole time. And I think that's really well done. There's a bunch of white people in the cast. I in particular had to really learn an awful lot. And I say this kind of, you know, with like a great deal of shame, but because I'm from London, and I haven't, to the best of my knowledge, I don't think I've ever encountered any indigenous communities or peoples when I've, you know, from America or Canada. And it was a big learning process about like talking to Kaylee and Izzy and JD and Anna and our indigenous producers, Princess and Tagnak, and just listening to the issues that affect their communities and stuff. And when we would like all go for drinks or dinner, I would just have a great deal of pleasure from just sitting there and listening to them talk.
What was very beautiful, I thought, was grief, that there is something out there. You can feel it the way you personally want to feel it, if it's still there or if it's not. And all those conversations that several characters have about that and are going through, did it give you any new thoughts? You were mentioning your mom, for example, any perspective?
Since I filmed the series, I haven't managed to visit Alaska, and I do hope to go one day, but I visited the Canadian Arctic. And I think when you're out there in the tundra on the land, you get a sense of why these places are so interlinked with mythology, but also kind of ghosts and spirits, and not necessarily like hauntings, but you know. And I think whereas before, when I started filming the series, I was much more on the kind of Liz Danvers side of this discussion, whereas I don't believe, I'm not a believer, I'm a rational human being. But I think once you've been up there and you kind of see this vast landscape, you really start to get a sense of that it's very possible that there's something else out there. And I think that's a comforting feeling. And I like being slightly more open to it now. I'm not trying to like contact ghosts or anything, but I like, it's comforting to know that loved ones you've lost might still be present in your life in some way.
What's next for you, Finn?
I'm shooting a little series at the minute out of London.
Cool. Is it a secret or?
No, it's not a secret. I think I'm allowed to. It's like an espionage thriller for Netflix, written by Joe Barton, who wrote Giri Haji, which is one of my all-time favorite series. And it's an espionage thriller starring Ben Whishaw and Keira Knightley. And yeah, this is what I want for myself in my career. I don't necessarily want to like lead something. I want to just be in good things with good people. And like, I don't have a massive part in this, but I have a substantial part. And the best thing is I get to work with those two, and I get to learn from them. I learned so much from Jodie Foster and John Hawkes and Kelly Reese, and now I get to go learn from other people. You get to see how they do things. That's what I'm doing at the minute, and I'm doing that for a couple more months.
Finally, are you happy that SpongeBob toothbrush came back?
Yeah, very happy. I love, like, you know, JD was one of the people I would hang out with quite a lot. I would go and play poker at his house with almonds as chips. And he just like, it's sad. We actually had a scene together that was written in an earlier draft of the script, but was dropped. And I just love that, like, now the series is out, I get to watch his work, because it's so funny. And I'm very happy that the SpongeBob toothbrush has made its way back to its rightful owner. And I think justice for Kavik, you know, that's very important. Yeah.
Ben, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Christina. This has been really wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much to Finn Bennett. All 6 episodes of True Detective Night Country are out now on HBO. And thank you so much for listening. Please subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts.
Science! 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 Hello, podcast fans. Want to get weird with us? Come check out the Mad Scientist Podcast. We are a weekly show that looks at the history, philosophy, and hard facts behind your biggest paranormal questions.
Did the government really pay for a psychic spy program?
Yes!
Is it true that surgery got its start in grave robbing?
Yes!
Can a roller coaster really kill you?
Legally, we can't say so for sure, but sometimes, yes! Mm. Join myself, Chris Cogswell, and my co-host, Marie Mayhew, as we examine the science, philosophy, and history behind the strange and unusual. All to discover what's possible and plausible versus what's, well, just made up. Check us out wherever you find your favorite podcasts. The Mad Scientist Podcast.